I'm your daddy.
I can be smart when it's important.
I'm your daddy.
Welcome to Daddy Dailies, a podcast hosted by Not Your Daddy's Films. On a film set, dailies are sent out after a shoot day so you can see the work in progress. Daddy Dailies are conversations that go behind the scenes so you can see what work went into the process and be better armed to succeed in the industry. Daddy Dailies, hosted by Not Your Daddy's Films.
Welcome back to Daddy Dailies, the podcast where we go behind the scenes with industry professionals and demystify the creative process so you can learn from the folks who have been there and done that. I'm Nicole.
And I'm Vika,
two of the founders of Not Your Daddy's Films. We first met when we screened her incredible short, Murder Camp, at one of our Not Your Daddy's Films short screenings. It's an absurdist horror comedy that is truly phenomenal. I'm obsessed. I still think about it all the time. Clara is an accomplished television director working on shows like Into the Dark, In the Dark, Nancy Drew, Tom Swift, and Walker, among others. And we're so excited to talk to them today. Clara Aronovic, welcome to Daddy Dailies.
Thank you so, so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here with y'all.
We're so happy. And if you are watching at home, and you can see us, we're all look like we are at a giant table in tiny chairs.
Which
is because we think this room was designed for men.
But aren't they all?
So we're really excited to talk to you about many things today, your career, your life, your opinions. But I was fascinated because on Instagram, you gave your followers the 411 on how you started out in this industry, and you started as a researcher on Mad Men. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got that job? Because I think it's just a fascinating story.
Absolutely. So I did go to film school, which is not me necessarily endorsing it. It's just me owning that. I'm going to just be honest with your listeners. I did go to film school. But
Where
I don't think
you go?
I went to USC for grad school.
Amazing.
I knew I wanted to be a filmmaker from a very young age, as I think might have been the case for both of you as well. And I was really excited to be studying film formally, but I also wanted some vocational training. I wanted to have an internship. At that point, I was on full loans, so I had what felt like a financial buffer. Of course, I eventually had to pay those back. but I had the freedom to pursue an internship. And I'm really going to date myself here. I don't know if they, do you know if the UTA job list is still a thing?
I don't know, but I used it.
So
you're not dating yourself. Like, I don't know how we're the same age or not, but I used it.
Doubt it, Vika. Bless you. Guessing different decades of birth, and that's okay. But okay, great. So the UTA job list existed.
Yes.
When you in school, which is totally
job.
The same time as me, and because same age. And so I the UTA job list, for those who don't know, is at least in my day something that would go out weekly. UTA is one of the top three major agencies, and this list was pretty lo-fi. It was like an HTML or just like text list of like internships and entry-level jobs in the industry, and you could get access to it by knowing someone at UTA. Who would then forward it to you, or you were on a mailing list. And by virtue of being a student at USC, we could get this list every week. And I knew that I loved research. My undergraduate degree was in literature, creative writing, and then I almost minored in Native American studies and theater. But I've always been a bit of a bookish nerd. Can we curse on this podcast?
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool, cool, cool. Not that I've got one in the chamber, but like, is gonna happen.
So let them out.
Okay.
You're worried that you can. It feels like they're always on the tip.
I know. I'm like, shit, fuck. Great. Okay, good. It's out.
And out.
So I knew I loved to research. So when I saw a posting on the UTA list for researching for a 1-hour show, it didn't specify anything. It just said 1-hour drama researcher. I was like, great, I'll submit my resume, thinking that it was a procedural, what have you. And I submitted my resume and then heard back, and they were like, great, you've made it to the next round. The show is Mad Men, which at the time was my absolute favorite fucking show.
I love that.
It's was
incredible.
It's on that alone, I was like, I have won the lottery of life just by getting past the first, you know, this is where this ends, I've won. And they said, so the next thing you have to do is answer these three questions. And they were extremely specific. One of them was like, how much would it cost to take the subway in 1963 to Coney Island from Midtown or something along those lines. One of them had to do with if you were to give birth in a hospital in New York around that time, what sort of questions would be on the entry forms?
Goodness.
And then the other one, I think, was at what time did Nixon give his concession speech? And they were like, answer these as soon as you can. And I remember I was driving from San Francisco to Los Angeles, which I do a lot. I'm from San Francisco. I live in L.A. when I received that email and immediately panicked and was like, I have to go straight to a library, which I did. And I answered the questions before the end of the day, before midnight, and was brought in for an interview, and I got the job.
That is so cool because it played to your strengths. You worked really hard and you didn't know it was your favorite show, which just feels fated in a cool way.
Yeah, it was such an honor, honestly. And the researchers, we started before the writers even came in. At the start of the season, we were each assigned one day per week. I think I started Tuesday. Again, unpaid internship, but I was literally sitting in the writer's office next to the door to the writer's room. And like all of the writers, including Matt Weiner, were walking past me every time that I was there. And it was a really welcoming environment. And I will also say that, of course, I was getting lunches and the right cigarette brands. you know, I was doing interning things, but the bulk of my work was researching. And I, again, being kind of bookish and loving the library, I love going through microfiches. I love doing all that shit and watching how a season comes together. And then by the end of the season, I was the only researcher who had lasted the whole season. Lasted suggests that it was like a difficult thing.
Cutthroat.
Yeah. that research will get you. But it was just a good fit. And by the end, I was basically part-time.
That's so cool. So, and in a previous episode, we talked to Alana Pena. So go back and listen to that one. And she broke down the roles in a writer's room. But there are sometimes jobs like on a period piece like this, like a researcher or there'll be consultants. So how did they use your research? And did you, if you started before the writers, did they have general areas or topics that they wanted you to kind of look into for them?
Correct. Yeah. So I came on for season 4. And before, there was a general story area that they knew they might push towards at the start of the season. So I don't remember the specific research at that time. But when we didn't have something specific to look into, they were like, okay, this is the week in history during which this episode takes place.
Whoa.
Go through newspaper, see if you find something. You know, something that I found, for example, that never made it into the show was randomly on some date in 1965. A whole bunch of fire alarms went off in Manhattan at the same time, and no one really understood why.
Aliens.
Yeah,
it had to be.
Yeah. Well, they didn't bite, but I loved that little tidbit.
Yeah,
you know, because what most people don't assume to be true of any show, but was certainly the case for Mad Men, is that show is day specific. Like, if it's raining in the show, it's because that day in history in Manhattan it was raining. So, you know, there were very specific, easy things that we researched. For example, Don Draper's going to go to the movies in this episode. What was playing at what theater on that day? And then there were broader things. You know, I remember doing research for an episode in which they are doing, Sterling Cooper is doing business with a Japanese firm, and they wanted to know more about Japanese customs at that time in business. You know, what would have been a gift? Gifts are really commonly given in Japanese corporate culture. What would be an appropriate gift to give and receive? Another thing I remember researching, which is a bit of a spoiler, but there is a character named Mrs. Blankenship, whom I loved, and she ends up passing away. She also got cataract surgery, so we had to look into, you know, what sunglasses she would wear, like, if any, what the aftercare for cataracts would be, and then also what happens to a body when it dies in an office in the 60s in New York.
Wow.
Those sorts of things. Or how to, the Sonny Liston fight also was during our season. So we had to research how you would make place an illegal bet on a boxing match.
You remember so much. This is like your brain.
I don't remember the answers to those questions. I just remember the questions.
Because these are such specific and seemingly random questions. I mean, obviously they're not random, but. Wow. Did that job and getting to be so close to the writer's room, did you carry anything you learned from that forward in your career?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, getting to just observe how Matt Weiner ran that show was such a gift in ways that I couldn't have perceived at the time. Of course, knowing so little about TV, I was just like, I just want to do what they're doing. But I got to watch how Matt would interface with every department head who would bring a costume in or a prop into the office and see what kind of considerations he was making. I actually vividly remember someone in props bringing over a stuffed, I want to say, elephant.
Whoa.
that was going to be given to Bobby, I think.
Was it Bar-Bar? I had a stuffed elephant.
Of a bar?
Yeah.
I don't think it was. I think it was a non-brand.
I mean, that would make sense for TV.
I mean, who knows, for Mad Men. But I remember vividly Matt taking a look at it and not with, you know, not denigrating it or putting down the word, but he's like, that's polyester. Just from looking at it. He's like, it was like a plushie with like furriness. And he's like, yeah, I can see that it's plasticky. It's too shiny for 1965.
Whoa.
Yeah. And I mean, attention to detail. The attention to detail, precisely. That's something that I tried to absorb. I don't know. I mean, Matt Weiner's on a different level. And, you know, he is superhuman in his capacity, like cognitive capacity. He went on Jeopardy and like won a couple episodes. Like he knows so much shit.
I did not know that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really remarkable how much he knows.
So, okay. So you mentioned you always wanted to be a filmmaker. So you went to UCLA, studied film.
USC.
Sorry.
Oh my God.
Sorry, we're rivals. I went to UCLA.
Wow. Respect.
Yeah. Same. Whoa. I feel caught between
worlds right now.
You know?
I feel deeply neutral.
It's come off.
Wow.
From the people who were there the most, the film major and the theater major.
You were theater major?
Yeah.
Oh, hell yeah, brother. We love theater. Yeah.
Oh, I hope we get to talk about that.
Oh, we will. We were all theater majors in this room, and we were all theater kids at heart.
But you came here to make movies or TV. I want to know, like, what your lifelong goal was, really. And, you know, I don't think you came here to be a researcher, but you took the job and learned a lot. What was the goal and the hope from there?
I mean, specific to that opportunity, I was like, I died to be a writer on the show. And it didn't come to fruition for a host of different reasons, mostly to do with the fact that there was a major hiatus between seasons 4 and 5. And maybe Matt was like never thinking of me in that way, but I was really angling towards being a writer's assistant, which would have been the next like logical step. And there was almost an entire year between the seasons. And in that time, new interns came in and the previous writer's assistant didn't get promoted. So there was no vacancy for me. And it wasn't for me. At the end of the day, like, I can kind of try and guess why something doesn't go the way I hope it does, but it just wasn't my path. But for a while, I was really sad about that because I was like, oh, I put in my time and I did good work and I thought I was well enough liked that I could move up here, but it wasn't the plan. That whatever universe got or the randomness that is life had for me. The goal broader, though, outside of Mad Men, was to make large-scale independent movies. That's my dream. It has been since I was a kid, and I'm still pushing in that direction.
Oh, that's very cool. So we met you through, as you mentioned at the beginning, your short Murder Camp. But you've directed a bunch of TV. How did that come about? How did you have mentors along the way who helped you get that first gig? Or, you know, going from wanting to be potentially a writer eventually in Mad Men to then directing television, how did that all happen? I know that's probably a long...
No, it's a great... It's honestly the question I get asked most.
Okay,
cool. The question I most frequently ask is, how did you get into TV directing? And it is my pleasure to share it because I like demystifying that progression.
Mm.
But I will say it is not an easily replicable journey because it's random as fuck. Like, and that's... If I could give like a headline for my career, it's the seeds that you thought would sprout often don't.
Mm.
And it's the ones that you didn't know you planted that were stuck to the bottom of your shoe that grew behind your back and turn into this like incredible plant. Like that's how life in my career has gone. And TV is an exemplary of that. The way I got into TV directing is the story would have to start, I would say, with Primrose, my first short film that actually had a festival circuit.
Mm-hmm.
Premiered at South by Southwest. I didn't know anyone at that point. I didn't, like, a lot of people at this point, like, have to know someone to get the attention of a programmer at a festival.
And can you give us, like, dates and timeline?
Yeah. So Primrose premiered in 2015. I graduated from USC in 2010. So in those 5 years, I can barely tell you. I was camera department. I did a lot of camera department, second AC, loader. I was producing. I was still writing. I got represented as a writer really quickly, but nothing was getting made. Hmm. And Primrose, Primrose came about. Okay, I'm going to take it another step back.
I love it.
Okay, great. So right after film school, not right after, a couple years after, I ended up taking this lead producing position on a James Franco film called Yosemite. His company, Rabbit Bandini, I'm not sure if they're still around. for cancellation reasons. I don't know.
Fair enough. We can, I'll do a quick Google.
Do a quick Google. Beautiful. Yeah. Tell us how Rama Bandini is doing. sorry. I was brought on to produce this feature and learned a lot, but promptly realized that producing was going to take my joy from me. It's not, I had much more joy as a second AC and loader than I did as a producer because I got to be in the magic of making movies and a part of a team. I really did not enjoy producing, though I had a facility for it. And so at that point, I was clear that I needed to monetize directing, and I had no idea how, because I had just planned. What did you find me? you know things.
It doesn't appear on James Franco's IMDb anymore, but it looks like now he has Ramona Films with his brother and Elizabeth Haggard.
Huh. I don't, well, so funny fact, Dave Franco and I went to high school together.
Really?
We did.
I mean, I feel like I would like him just based on watching his work. I don't know.
That's lovely. I mean, it was a pretty big public school. No surprise here, guys. I wasn't cool. I wasn't very cool.
No,
Davey
you
was
were
cool.
Probably very cool, but just people don't understand yet.
Thank you. That's what I like to think. But so pursuant to producing Yosemite, which was, to be clear, a great opportunity. Mm-hmm. I learned a lot, as I said. It was, and I really, really liked the writer-director, Gabrielle Demastier, and it premiered at Slamdance. It had a, you know, decent run for an indie. But I knew I had to monetize directing, and I hadn't ever directed a commercial of any kind because, like many, when I was in my early 20s and mid-20s, I was like, commercials are for hacks. I'm here to make serious things.
To make art.
LOL. Now I'm like, give me another episode of a procedural, baby.
Yeah, give it that funny, honey.
Please let me survive. So I
feel like I have to just do a PSA. I work on a procedural. Procedurals can be art.
Yeah. Oh, I will get to that.
I think they can. I said that facetiously, but I really do think they can. But also there is a lot of crap out there, as we all know.
100%. And in fact, I'll do a quick fast forward to say some of the best artists and technicians I've ever met in my career are working in network TV.
Mm.
They're just happy to be
paid
to have a stable career. And they are the best in their field. And you would never know who they were. Mm. Right?
Yeah.
The fact that Larry Tang is not a household name is insane.
Yeah, I agree.
It's insane. And for those watching and listening, he's a network TV director whom Vico has shadowed. I consider him a mentor. And he's one of the greatest filmmakers I've ever witnessed in my life.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that.
So, yeah, all of this, like, my journey has been one away from being a pretentious highbrow piece of shit to realizing, like, I'm blessed to get to do this job. Yeah. On someone else's dime, and to accrue skill as a creative, as a technician, as a craftsperson, and as an artist, that I would never look down my nose on that at this point. But in my mid-20s, I was like, God, I have to make commercials. How has anyone been lower than this? Not realizing, like, if you just getting a commercial is a fucking coup.
Yeah.
Like, holy shit. So I was like, what am I going to do? And at that time, again, I might be dating myself. There was a real prevalence of these commercial directing competitions.
Yeah, the Doritos ones. I remember those.
Oh, Crash the Super Bowl.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
They were a big deal.
I made one of those.
Did you?
I didn't too.
We didn't either.
I never made a Doritos one because I was like, numbers game wise, I'm not going to win here. But I did discover through another friend of mine, Raul Fernandez, an incredible filmmaker, that there was this company called MoFilm out of the UK. And they had much smaller competitions for legitimate brands like Chevrolet and Nestle. And they would say, like, offer a brief and you could, like the Doritos thing, make your own spec on your own dime, which is why I think this is kind of shady, and, you know, submit for a competition. And if you win, you might actually get like $4,000, which is a shit ton of money for 20 something, especially like pre-inflation disaster that we're in presently.
Yeah.
And you'll get flown to a cool city around the world and wine and dine for like 4 days. It was a blast. And so I kept my head down and I don't even know how I financially survived TBH. Like, I was just doing random shit. And I did a slew of those in a row and was fortunate enough to win most of them and got a little nest egg. Not a nest egg. Oh, God. I didn't have savings until, like, yesterday. But, like, you know.
What's that
like? What's that like, right? Girl. But I built a reel. And it was while I was making one of these tiny commercials, I got a $1,000 grant. You could apply for a tiny grant. I got a $1,000 grant. And it was for an energy company in Canada. And I went up with one friend who had a DSLR camera, an actor, and myself. The three of us went to Canada and made this little commercial, which ended up winning. And we had a free afternoon. And I said, okay, Clara, what do you have at your disposal? I had a campground in Alaska. I had this actor who was my ace in the pocket because he is one of the apes from Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Oh. So he has an incredible ability and training to act like an ape. And then I have a camera guy with a camera with a fucking shotgun mic mounted on top of it. And yourself, what can you make in an afternoon? And I pitched to them this idea I had, which turned into Primrose. And they looked at me like I was nuts. They were like, no. And I was like, what? I was like, guys, will you make this cool short? Trust me, the opening frame is this. I pitched it from beginning, opening frame to closing frame as you see it now. It was just so clear to me. And they're like, no, it's my only free afternoon in Alaska. And that idea is weird. And I was like, okay, guys, I got to go pee. I'm going to go to the outhouse and I'll be back. But it was campground. Let me talk you into this. And I remember vividly walking to the latrine. Is there a cuter way to say it?
The hole in the ground.
The hole in the ground that has a wooden box around it.
Finding that in the middle of the night at a campground is not
terrifying. Suboptimal.
Yeah,
but I remember walking to that thing. I mean, like, okay, Clara, direct, like, inspire these people to see your vision. Cause I had this fucking knowing. I was like, I know this idea is weird, but it just feels right. And I convinced them. We shot it, took 3 hours. I cut it together on my laptop and submitted it to South By and got in.
What? That's insane.
Which is insane.
Can you give like a synopsis and or tell our listeners where to watch this if there's a place?
Absolutely. So Primrose, mercifully, was distributed by Nowness, which I loved and was obsessed with at the time. And it also got a Vimeo staff pick. So you can just search Primrose Vimeo and you'll find it. But it premiered at South By, and it's very short. Here's the general premise. The premise is, I call it a romantic comedy. Which if you watch it, I'm scared. It's very strange. But this guy acts like an ape and I'm acting in it and I don't direct myself. Like, that's how desperate I was to make this thing. Mm-hmm. There's no one else to work with. But it's a ape meets gal. And that's all I say. And I knew I had the clarity that I wanted to make something that had three acts and was as short as I could make it. I had this feeling that if I made a really complete, satisfying short in under 5 minutes, that the short would have a higher chance of getting programmed.
Very true.
Proved to be true. And I ended up being a screener for South By for 2 seasons after that. And I know that's especially true. So that's another little tidbit I can offer to your listeners and viewers. The shorter your short is and the more satisfying it manages to be in under 10 minutes, ideally, the better positioned your short is to get into a festival.
Yeah, we love that. I mean, when we're programming Not Your Daddy's Films, we're always looking for short shorts. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, because from like also the more like the shorter it is, the more we can fit into a block. And mm-hmm. That is great because then people get to see your work and we're not like keeping them there for hours and hours.
Yeah,
100%. What we say way too often is, there's a 10-minute short in any short. It's over 10 minutes, try again.
Right? Which was actually, to fast forward a bit, one of the things that I was upset about, not upset, but like slightly disappointed with in Murder Camp. I was like, why can't we get this shorter? And it just couldn't be shorter. There's no air in that fucking movie.
I mean, I love it.
It's supposed to be, I don't even, in my memory, it is under 10 minutes because every short that I like in my memory is under 10 minutes. Even if it actually secretly is 20. It feels fast, you know?
That's great. That's the greatest feedback I could hope for.
It shouldn't feel long. Exactly. I don't think you ever really want that feedback as a filmmaker.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Called a short film.
Yeah, short film. But so Primrose had a healthy little life. And then at that point, I had a small reel put together. And then finally started booking some work. I was able to get some music videos. I was able to get some commercials. I started in the Hispanic market because I'm Hispanic. My parents are from South America. They're immigrants from Argentina and Chile. So I worked in Spanish with more facility. There was a little bit more room there. And then I was able to expand into general market. All of this conspired to get me a general meeting at a company called Adaptive in, I think, 2017. And they have since been acquired, but they were in the business of web series, which makes me laugh.
Yeah.
Web series business in the same sentence, like what? But there was this thing called like Quibi for a while, as you may remember.
Yeah.
All right,
so Quibi shows when I was at Sony, so
people thought it was gonna be
the next big thing,
which is so laughable. No, well, listen, our attention span
pandemic.
people were at home. No one was going to be watching this on their commute to work.
That's true. But so I pitched an original web series to Adaptive called Tantalum, and I got greenlit. It was my first time ever getting to make something long form. It's a got a total run of 70 minutes over 7 episodes. We shot it in Detroit, and I felt like it really showed what I could do. I finally was able to kind of expand, spread my wings, and be like, look at all these things that I've been doing while I haven't been greenlit to make a feature.
And did you write all of it yourself?
I did. And I will say that my writing is weak. I only had 30 days to script the whole thing. And it's when I watch it, I feel a little bit of a cringe. Come on.
But isn't that always the case when you look back at your like early work of anything?
Certainly. But I will say of all the things with Tantalum, for me, it's the writing that I'm like, oh, God. But it premiered at Tribeca, which was also a mitzvah. And then the company who owned it got acquired. And even though we had a distributor who wanted it, Alter wanted to distribute it, which was amazing. But they could only pay like a couple grand, which again, nothing to sneeze at for me, a constantly broke filmmaker. But the company who owned it was like, we don't do web series anymore. So it's a no. And we tried for 2 or 3 years to get the rights and couldn't. So it continues to sit on a shelf, but it has a happy ending. But as you can imagine, I was like heartbroken.
Of course.
I was like, but the world was finally going to see that I know what I'm doing. And these technicians and these artists gave so much of themselves in this piece, and they trusted me, and it's not even out in the world. Like, what could I have done differently? It even premiered at Tribeca. Like, I was like, what do you want from me, world? And then, totally randomly, and it was at Tribeca, I want to say, in 2018. And in 2019, I get a text from someone I hadn't spoken to in 3 years. We were not close. We were like homies in our 20s, but like he got married and like the whole group disbanded because everyone basically got married. And he was like, hey, have you ever directed long form? And I was like, not really. I have this web series. And he's like, send it to me. So I sent it to him. And what he didn't tell me is that he was going to share it with a showrunner. And that showrunner really responded to the web series. And they brought me in for an interview on that TV show. And I prepared for that interview like I've never prepared for fucking anything in my life, y'all. Like, I watched every single episode like the most fastidious student on the planet. I took notes on every episode. It was like, you should have seen it. Like, basically short of doing the, like, serial killer trying to wall with all the string on it, I was like, how does this show work? I'm going to know fucking everything. And I come in for that interview exceptionally prepared, and I booked the job. And I did a good enough job on that episode that I got invited back. And I did a good enough job when I got invited back that other shows on that network were like, who's she? We want her.
And what was that show called?
That show is called In the Dark on the CW. It is since canceled, but it had a wonderful run, had a great life. And I was invited back every season after that first one. And it then went on Netflix and had another great life there.
And that is a true testament to you. I work on I'm in the writer's office on a network procedural, and we hire directors, and we don't always ask directors back. So because it's really a hard challenge to not only execute the showrunner's vision, have your own, like, because I firmly believe that everyone infuses themselves into whatever they do, even if it's you're not paying attention to that as a viewer, and then also do it in 8 days or 7 days or whatever short timeline you have to make all of this come to life. So congratulations. That's really cool that you're able to do that on your first like network TV, or I don't know if it was, yeah, network. Yeah. CW, network TV job.
Can we go back to that very first episode? What was going on in your mind? And like, yeah, were you just like shitting yourself? I don't know. It was your first episode of TV.
Great question. Did I shit myself? I mean, proverbially, yeah. In some ways, but this actually, that brings me back to what can I control and what can't I? Most things are out of our control. What I figured I would do is ask, hey, can I shadow on the episode before me? If all I would need is for you to fly me up earlier. And they're like, oh, we can fly you up earlier. We'll ask the other directors, because there's a prepping director and a shooting director who are working simultaneously. So upon their approval, the show was like, sure, we'll fly you up early. We can't put you up early. And I was like, bet, no worries. I have a place to stay in Toronto. I didn't. I posted on Instagram, does anyone know fucking anyone in Toronto? And a friend from college, whom I, again, had not spoken to in a long time, was like, oh, my buddy, like, totally has an apartment. And I slept on a couch. I slept on a couch for a week. after being flown for the first time in first class.
Wow.
Internationally, broke as broke could be. And for that week on the couch, I shadowed. And at that point, I kind of got to do a lot of recon. I started the name memorization. I was able to see what the vibe of the set was, what the pace was of the set. Mm-hmm. I started to observe what are some of the patterns of the actors and tics of the actors and department heads, just get the lay of the land and make myself known. I also asked to gain access to the dailies, which not every show permits, but I've been lucky. Every show but one has said yes to me, which is how I identified Larry Tang as most brilliant man I've ever met was actually by watching his dailies, which was the next show I did was Nancy Drew, and that's how I met Larry Tang. And so I just studied the shit out of it so that I wouldn't be voiding my bowels when I got there.
And for the listener, shadowing is exactly what it sounds like. You are the literal shadow of the director. You, you know, you're there for all of the prep meetings, which is usually like about a week before the episode. And then you are there on set with them as they're directing the crew, the actors, et cetera, et cetera.
So, okay,
go ahead.
I'm just building the timeline of your fucking phenomenal career. So this first episode was
End of 2019,
which is
something was about to
something,
happen.
Yes.
What was it? What was it?
So what happened then?
What happened then was, mercifully, I also booked an open directing assignment to do an installment of Blumhouse's Into the Dark.
Yes.
Not to be confused with In the Dark.
Yes.
Which is a feature anthology series. This one was being co-produced with Eat the Cat, which is Nick Antosca's company. He did Chucky and The Act. His wife, Ali Peckman, wrote it. And that is called Tentacles. Not to be confused with Tantalum. I have so many like things on my IMDb that could be the same thing.
That's amazing.
It's so bizarre. And so Tentacles is technically a feature. So you could say I've directed a feature, but I kind of orient towards it like TV because so many things were prescribed to me and I didn't write it, although Ali did a great job writing it. And we shot, so I went straight from, I went straight from shooting In the Dark, that first episode, again, flying first class for the first time, my first like legitimate paycheck, going from like basically almost negative bank balance to like having a little bit of money in my account, to then shooting a music video. That's what happened right after that. And I remember I was in a middle seat on Coach and I was like, oh, wow. Oh, the whiplash.
You're talking to someone who currently does music videos and can't wait for that first class, first TV episode. Mm-hmm. So and I hear you.
Yeah, man. And here I am being like, I'm dying to do a music video again. Truly, truly dying to.
Tradesies.
Tradesies. But then, so I went from that music video, which was for a track called Unchained for Devin Gilfillian. And then I went straight into production for Tentacles in March of 2020. And we shot 5 days.
Oh,
and
no.
We got shut down.
Oh.
We got shut down. And again, I was like, oh, no, it's happening again. Like with my web series, I did everything I could and I owe it to these artists. I have this like completely disproportionate sense of duty, like that I like. Part of it is true. I do feel as directors, we owe a lot to our cast and crew.
Absolutely. Yeah. Agreed.
And then there's also, again, a lot that's out of our control. I'm no one's mom. And it wasn't the pandemic. I couldn't do anything about the pandemic.
You should have stopped it.
I should have stopped it, which was really rude of me that I didn't.
At least now we know who to blame.
Right? It's me. Yeah.
It was you heard me. It here first.
Yeah.
I was scheduled to shoot my first short ever that I was, well, the first one I put money into, March 14th, 2020.
No. I was scheduled to shoot a music video starring Danny Trejo, end of March 2020.
That's cool.
But it's okay because we still did it just, you know, many months later. No, it was still, I think it was still 2020 when we did it. But it was like that first reopening when we had like a week and then we realized too soon. So,
yeah.
But yeah, it was a disappointing month.
It was a rough month for a lot of us.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, wow, here we go again, like another big disappointment, which is something that we experienced so much in our career. Yeah. On the one hand, I was practiced at it. I was so used to hearing no, but I was not used to finally starting a feature and shutting down for a pandemic.
Yeah.
That was a first for me. But we did get to complete production in September of 2020. But you can imagine, like, it felt a bit like Frankenstein together. We did all this research and development for the titular Tentacles to be done practically. And then we, and then over the summer, like, we were told to do it in 2D animation.
2D?
Yeah, straight up. Like, we're like, okay, part of this film is now animated. And I was like, what? And I was like, okay, like, we're going to make,
we're just going to do it.
We're going to do it. And we found a way that was going to be kind of creepy and weird and intergenre. And I was like, you know what? What a blessing. Here we go. We start shooting. And then what that also afforded us was dropping a couple days off of our shooting schedule, because we also had to go down from two cameras to one because of COVID stuff. We had to change locations because we couldn't have as many people on set. So we had to drop off the second camera crew. So we just couldn't have finished the movie if we hadn't just animated part of it. But the twist is, a couple days into our September unit, they were like, JK, we're going to do it all on set and it's going to be CG tentacles. And we're like, we have not prepped for this.
Did you, have you ever, had you ever worked with, like,
no, ma'am,
the effects in that way?
No, ma'am.
Did they also, like, connect you with the right people to make that happen? Or were you just like,
what? Yeah, eventually. I mean, we, my AD team, who were incredible, and I, we were like, well, first off, surely you're giving us more days on the schedule. And they're like, no, no. And we're like, but you have to, we have to, there are strips we have to put back on the board, like the sky.
Right. You have, don't you have to shoot like a plate?
We have to shoot the scenes that were going to be animated. We found our way. We had to take another day off to do some R&D, and we prepped it, and it's fine. There's a movie. That's a miracle.
But is it not always, though?
Yes.
Like, every movie is a miracle.
Every movie is a miracle. Hashtag prayer hands, 100%. But that's, you know, so, like, again, like with my web series, you know, is it the exact vision that I had for it? No. Are there a lot of things that kind of make me cringe? Yes. But, like, that we have any movie is unbelievable. And frankly, I'm still really proud of that directing work.
Yeah.
We all grew, all of us, like our actors, everyone put some really great work together for that.
I think that's incredible. And you always learn, even if you're like, you wouldn't do anything differently. And it's a growth experience. Also, I've never done, maybe I'm a masochist, I've never done anything where I've been like, well, I would have done that exactly the same.
No, never.
Yeah.
You learn every single time.
Yeah. So, okay. So your big dream was to be like this feature director. You got to do it and you want to do it again.
Yeah. I mean, again, I orient towards tentacles as a TV job because of its workflow and because I didn't write it myself. But I have directed a thing with a runtime of 90 minutes that is technically standalone. And I hope to do that again with things that I've written.
Do you have a dream job or project?
I have several, but I definitely have something that I finally wrote my first personal spec in many, many years.
Cool.
That we're hoping to start taking out next month.
Very exciting.
As an artist, as a director, are there things that are most important to you when you're looking to take your next job?
I mean, listen, I'm just going to shoot it to you straight.
Please do.
Happy to just work right now. Aim a strike. I haven't been on a TV set in a year. And that feels very bad. And that, the way I phrase that suggests maybe I've been on another set in a year. I haven't. I just haven't been on a set in a year.
But you wrote your movie.
I wrote my movie, and I run a 501c3 nonprofit theater company with a couple of pals. So I've been very busy, but it does feel like, as a director, I feel, if I'm not directing, man, I feel like a sheepdog without a herd.
Dude, I understand.
And I will start herding other people who are like, I'm not your sheep.
Yeah.
I'm like, but I have opinions on what you're doing. You know, you could do it better.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Nothing has ever been more real.
That statement. Yeah. So, you know, so I'm currently at a place in which I would take almost anything. And then I have the personal, you know, there's the ideal and then there's the real. If my career progresses in the way that I hope it does, I'd love to be a little bit more selective. But there have been many shows that I've turned down, including ones that I super regret turning down.
That's interesting.
Oh yeah. Frankly, that I probably can't get into specifics, but I basically got invited to a show that I should have said yes to. It was wildly popular, but I had just come off of a show with like some cast that had attitude problems. And as y'all know, that's kind of everywhere. And I was early enough in my career at which, you know, I was like, you know what? It's not worth it. It's not worth it. I don't care how cool your show is. I just want everyone to get along. And you know what? That's silly. Especially because I feel pretty adept at handling big personalities. I think that's part of why I've done okay myself in TV. And so at that point in my career, I was like, I just need to hear that it's good people that I'm working with. And that is ideal. And I have, thanks in large part to Larry and the kind of Larry Tang universe, like I have gotten to work with a lot of wonderful people. But should have taken that job. It would have really helped build the brand.
But you are about to be back on set directing a whole bunch of TV, right? A block?
Not a block, just a single episode. But happy to do it. A first season show that has been renewed, which is very exciting. Tracker on CBS.
Yeah, very exciting.
Go watch Clara's work.
Yay.
Yes.
So follow up to not only how are you choosing your next project, but I'm curious about your relationship with your reps and what they're sending you and how you decide together, or do you just decide?
I mean, to clarify, I made it sound like I would really take anything right now, which because of the dire straits post-strike, I might. But there, we do still have certain things that we know we would probably never say yes to, because it just doesn't feel like me. You know, there, even though I've bounced around a bit, for the most part, I've only worked in one-hour drama that has some opportunity for like little moments of humor. And my reps and I are very clear on what the longer-term vision is and the kinds of shows I would like to be working on. You know,
So what's your dream show?
Oh, Severance.
Yeah, I love that.
Let's manifest that for you.
Yeah, that would be remarkable if we did.
Dear listener, call Clara.
Ben Stiller.
Dear Ben Stiller,
please hire me. But it's a perfect show, and it's what's great is because there's so many more things coming out that are intergenre, which is what I've always been. It's easier to have these conversations with my reps and with other people, with producers, with companies and financiers, because before, you know, like 10 years ago, when I would talk about Yorgos Lanthimos's work, not as many people really knew or about whom I was speaking. And they got really nervous when I would say, well, it's funny, but it's really horrific.
Yeah.
You know, it was also pre-Parasite. You know, no one would have guessed that a like deeply horrific, very funny South Korean film was going to win everything.
Yeah.
You know, and now that that's happened, it's blown open these conversations that I have with my rep. And we constantly affirm every year in the form of meetings. Usually at the top of the year and the end of the year, we'll have kind of a clarifying conversation about what our goals are, how many episodes I would like to that year, what I would like to write that year, meetings that I would like to be having. And we just affirm like, okay, what's our North Star? You know?
I love that.
Sounds like you have a very healthy relationship with your reps, which is
amen.
I try to. And what I'd offer there is always remember that it's kind of crass and a bit capitalistic to put it in these terms, but I really mean it. You're your own brand. And I don't just mean in the kind of work you're doing, the style of work you're doing. I mean, you're your own brand of collaborator. I want to be someone about whom people feel generally positive when I step off of a set from them. You know, I want like, and not because I want to control, I want to people please. I just mean like, I know how I want to leave a set.
Once good I'm vibes.
Done. Good vibes. I want to invite collaboration. I want people to feel seen. I want them to know that I'm going to look them in the eye. I want them to see that if I make a mistake, I own it and I don't make it a drama and I move forward. And I bring that to my relationship to my reps. I lead every conversation with them with what could I be doing better for you? I don't lead with how are you disappointing me? Because they have a shit ton of clients who are also out of work right now.
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, obviously difficult climate. What can I do?
Yeah.
Like, well, this is what I do see is selling. You know, I see this potential opportunity. If maybe you brush up that script, I'm like, great. How can I arm you to do your job, your best work? And that's exactly how I approach everybody with whom I collaborate.
Did you decide together that the strike was the perfect time for you to write your spec?
Basically, yeah. And, you know, major credit to my manager who's kind of new to me. I was previously at Management 360 and then I left them and I'm now at Kaplan Perron. My relatively new, I would say we've been together for about a year and change, manager Hannah Ozer. When I first sent all of my work over to her, I gave her log lines of every feature I'd ever written. And she actually flagged the first one I ever wrote. It was like, hey, have you ever thought about, this is this absurdist coming of age monster movie. She's like, have you ever thought of kind of revisiting this? And I was like, absolutely not. That script is atrocious and embarrassing. And it's the first thing I ever wrote, like while still in film school. And she's like, I don't know, there's something about this conceit that might be worth exploring now that you kind of know your voice. And that is what I did.
Page one
rewrote that because of her suggestion.
That's a good collaborator.
Yeah. So in the vein of the question that you asked your reps, is there something that our listeners who are directors at varying levels, you know, something they could be doing today to become a better director?
I'm not going to say anything that's like groundbreaking,
but I'll affirm what has worked for me and what I would tell the people who have asked to shadow me and is probably what they're already doing. Watch everything. Truly just watch everything and watch it with a notebook if you're at home. Like I do a lot of just mapping of plot and seeing when certain milestones happen in films just so that I can continue to develop my understanding of rhythm and pace. Reading the scripts of the movies I love. The top two that I always recommend are the script for Michael Clayton and the script for The Princess Bride. I just find those to be exceptional, just exemplary of the craft. And there's so many more that, like, I mean, like, Boogie Nights is one of my favorites of all time. But it's, like, a hard one to replicate, right?
Yeah,
it's like, there's what William Goldman is able to do in The Princess Bride and to do, and how he does it so freshly is, like, wow, if he's, like, talk about a North Star, you know?
Yeah, I think that's something I often tell. I have interns in the writer's room, and it's kind of shocking to me, but I had to be told to do exactly that. I didn't have the idea myself. So I sit with a notebook, but also so many of these scripts are available online. So if you want to direct television or you want to direct movies, watch it and then watch it again, but watch it with the script so that you can see, okay, is that what happened? What changed? You know, if you can get your hands on something before the shooting script, that's helpful too.
Absolutely. Yeah. I didn't go to film school. I went to theater school for acting, but I taught myself how to write a pilot just by reading pilots and watching every single TV show ever.
Yeah.
God, I love TV so much.
Mm-hmm. And so.
Yeah, I think it's... And by talking to some really amazing friends and mentors. God bless, thank God. But, yeah.
Speaking of theater and your company, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, absolutely. With pleasure. It's called Public Assembly. We founded in 2018, and we took a couple years off because of the pandemic. But we are now a 501c3 nonprofit, and our mission statement is that we're trying to reinvent community theater in Los Angeles. The majority of the work we put up is written by people who sat in our audience, because the only prerequisite to write for us is that you sat in our audience. We basically, the format of the show is we have a monthly show at the end of each month, the final Thursday of each month. We put up a show of 3 to 4 one acts, essentially, that center around a theme that the previous month's audience proposed. So our audience is the source of our writing. It's the source of our theme. And we put these shows up in kind of unusual spaces around Northeast LA, like the Masonic Lodge or an American Legion or a church or a synagogue. And attendance is free for the first 50 people. The rest of the tickets are pay what you want. And we offer an open bar with both alcoholic and non-alcoholic options. And the dream was to address the pain points that we perceived were in holding a lot of LA theater back, considering the abundance of talent we have here. You're like, this, yeah. There's so much, there's this embarrassment of riches, and you can't convince most actors to sign on to a play because they're like, I moved here to be in TV. I moved here to not be taken out of the rotation for 3 months of rehearsal on a show that, you know, if you're lucky, goes up at like the Geffen, and only people who can afford $150 tickets, who are mostly older cishet white people, come, and they're only there because it's a rerun of a show that they've seen 50 times already. You know what I mean? We're like, yeah. We don't like that model. So we receive a theme from our audience on the night of the show. And at that point, anyone who's ever been to a show can offer a pitch. And we curate, write, develop, rewrite, cast, rehearse those pieces in basically 3.5 weeks. And because that's the time frame, the level of the caliber of actor who is willing to go on this journey with us for free, donate their time, is incredible.
I love that.
That's what we do over at Public Assembly.
So, okay, so you went to film school, not theater school, and knew you wanted to be a filmmaker. So how did you find yourself, I guess, kind of enamored with and you know, in this theater world? And is there anything you pull from your theater existence in your theater world that you bring back to set with you?
Oh, for sure. And in fact, I would say that my experience in theater is one of the things that made me most attractive when I was being interviewed for that first TV show. So if you have a lot of theater experience, don't be like, oh, fuck, like I'm not like it should have been spending all that time making shorts. Not necessarily. There's a lot of showrunners who really will favor theater people because of their ability to work with actors and their ability to track story.
Yes, because I didn't go to film school, but I specifically went to theater school as a playwright because the focus was so much more on storytelling rather than on technicals. now I have this huge insecurity that I don't know enough about cameras and lighting and whatnot. I know about like stage lighting, but I do think that has made me a stronger writer. They are different skills, but one informs the other.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
And I mean it. I've heard showrunners say, I want to work with a playwright or with a theater director. You know, we just watched Celine Song get greenlit for at our $12 million budget for her first feature without even making a director's lookbook for past lives, because of her robust theater experience. And to answer your question about like what drew me to theater, I've always been in love with theater. I did theater in second grade. Is like when I say in some interviews, I've said I've wanted to be a filmmaker since I was 7. The reason I say that is because that's when I started my first play.
I love that.
Yeah. They've always been very intertwined for me. And what I bring over to my filmmaking is, as mentioned, my passion for working with actors.
Absolutely.
And also, man, a sense of like obligation and relationship with audience.
Yes.
You know, even though the audience is far removed from me on a TV set, you know, and that film is going to go through so many, that footage is going to go through so many hands before it reaches an audience. I'm never not thinking about the audience because of my experience in theater.
Do you ever think about the crew as the audience? I've heard Ruben Östlund gave this advice that blows my mind, that he insists that everyone who's on set has to like focus on and pay attention to the actors. Like you can't just have like a grip like scrolling on his phone in the middle of a take, because the actors like feel that like an audience.
Wow, no, I have never heard that. And I will say that Force Majeure is one of my favorite movies of all time. Like,
right.
I wish I had made.
So
yeah, very interesting.
We are almost at the end, so I just want to ask one more question and then play a little game.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Go ahead.
I think because so much of our Not Your Daddy's Films community is in the time of their career where they're making short films, and that's how you started, and that kicked off your entire directorial journey. What advice do you give to a new short director, writer, creator, and what advice do you have for the shorts girlies?
Shorts girlies,
shorts daddies.
And shorts daddies.
Excuse me.
I mean, first and foremost, I'm just like, please pat yourself on the back for making this really scary, intimidating choice. Making anything is such an act of, it requires such courage and vulnerability. And what I would wish for someone who's embarking on that is just ceaseless sense of wonder and curiosity. Because you can learn, as we said earlier, from everything, absolutely everything. And like, if you go in without this belief that you have to have every answer and that, you know, you can bring, like, it's actually really cool. Your greatest asset is your inspiration. It is extremely infectious. That's another reason why I know I've been asked back on TV shows, because people can tell I just fucking love it.
Yeah.
You know, geek out. Don't get so bogged down. Like, better said, prep enough. Like, focus so much on your prep work so that you can arrive on set with a lightness and kind of wearing your prep work like a sweater, you know, and just have fun, because the shoot is the shortest amount of time on your timeline. You're going to spend way more time in prep and way more time in post. So if you can just find like joy and allow that joy to multiply itself amongst your cast and crew and be humble and realize that you have so much to learn from other people while maintaining a clarity of vision, you're going to hit it out of the park. And the last I'll offer on that front is also to just be process oriented rather than product oriented. Who the fuck knows? I have seen incredible short films get into no festivals. Who knows? But did like, case in point, my fucking web series, it is languishing on a shelf. It is going nowhere, quote unquote, and it got me into TV.
Yeah.
That takes me back to this metaphor of the seeds that you thought were going to sprout, didn't sprout. I had no fucking clue. You could call that a failure, and yet it is the greatest success of my career, and no one will ever see it. So just be open-minded about where things can lead you.
I think that's incredible advice. Thank you.
Yes.
I'm going to cry. So we just want to play a little game of rapid fire.
Oh God.
Oh God.
We're going to freeze up.
No. They're like questions.
Now that we know each other.
Well, you kind of, maybe it's a different answer from what you said earlier, but favorite TV show of all time?
What? Guys, come on. We can't.
Okay. The one that you rewatch the most.
That's rude. I can. Of all time?
All time. That's hard. I don't have an answer.
No puedo. No, pero por favor.
Okay. Something you watched recently that you love.
Something that I watched recently that I love. I mean, what an incredible season we just had with, like, The Zone of Interest. Are you kidding? 2 days ago, I saw Problemista, which I thought
was
wonderful.
I'm seeing it at the WGA next weekend.
Yeah, support Julio.
It's amazing.
It's wonderful. It's really wonderful. I really enjoyed that. But yeah, The Zone of Interest rocked my fucking...
I haven't seen it yet.
Mind what mega.
I have to watch
that
it.
That one's perfect.
Drink of choice.
Drink of choice, Spindrift.
Sponsor us.
Mango orange.
I'm a Spindrift person as well.
Yeah.
Can't leave home without.
God, I was just like, wallet and keys.
That's so lame. I mean, you
That's
can't.
That's so lame. I do like taking a book with me. I really take to heart. I read Stephen King's book on writing, which highly recommend.
Okay.
I haven't even really read. I'm a scaredy cat, so I can't read most of his books. But he wrote this incredible book on the craft, which is so funny. And I was like, damn, this guy knows how to write. Brilliant, Clara. Yeah, you figured it out. That's like pilgrims discovering America. But
like, did you an amazing analogy.
Have you heard of the Stephen King guy? But he talks about always having a book. And I really like that. And he talks about cultivating the skill of being able to pick up in the middle of the book and read a couple pages when you're waiting in line. And I've been trying to do that myself. So I'll say I don't leave without a book.
What book is in your bag right now?
In my bag right now is one that I just cracked open, so I don't feel comfortable endorsing it because I don't know if I like it. But what I will tell you, what I just finished, is a beautiful book on rewilding by Isabella Tree. I love nonfiction, and it's basically about the process of rewilding a 3,500-acre property in the south of England.
Oh.
By way of, like, introducing large herbivores. It's incredible, and I loved reading it.
That was a thing, but also makes perfect sense.
It's incredible. It's
I like
very
the term
inspiring.
Rewilding. I want to use it, like, personally.
Yeah.
Let's
yeah.
all just rewild this week, right?
Yeah. Now, let's introduce some herbivores, large herbivores, into our life. I just want to be grazed upon by a bison.
It'll fix all my problems.
Movie snack yeah. choice.
Oh, what a great segue. Are you the John August of this podcast? Script notes plug.
Yeah.
Segue.
It's movie snack of choice. Great question. Really depends on the theater. So I'm going to have to ask for you to be more specific.
AMC.
AMC? It's so trashy. But when I saw Problemista, I had...
I'm so embarrassed. Why are you saying this, Clara? The, like, sweet tart ropes?
Wait, why are you embarrassed?
Yeah, what?
That's
really cute.
That's some trashy candy.
They also had the most wild commercials, and I loved them.
Oh, yeah.
They're very
well,
I for sure thought you were going to say
Kidman.
Oh, yeah.
No, for good silence.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Nothing horrible.
Nicole was like, "What happened to our patrons?"
Like,
did they take down?
No, they're gonna make.
They're
more.
Making more. That's what I read, and I was like, "Yeah, okay, phew, thank God."
No, but I love a Junior Mint. I love a chocolate covered almond. I'm an old lady, but then the sweet tart rope thing happened.
Wow,
and so I don't have popcorn.
Okay, I was gonna ask. You haven't mentioned popcorn. Now you mentioned popcorn, so we're good.
Well, AMC is now doing Hidden Ranch popcorn.
Shut up.
I won't.
What?
I won't shut up. It's true. I just
you heard it here. Was it incredible?
Yeah, it was great.
How is this the first time hearing of this?
I don't know.
I've been working too much.
I will say, if a theater has a pretzel, sign me up.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm at the Alamo, I love the Alamo Bowl. Oh. And fried bagels.
I'm hungry.
Yeah.
And their milkshakes. Continue. Yeah.
I think on that note, maybe we should wrap this up and go get some dinner. Okay. The last one. Besides Nancy Drew, who is your favorite fictional detective?
Oh, man. I mean, what jumps out at me is, like, Poirot because classic, but I don't want that to be my answer. So I'm going to say Murphy, lead character from In the Dark, who is blind and a saucy lady who might have a drinking and sex and love problem. Ooh. But we love her.
We love a complex female character.
She is actually very fun, and she's played by Perry Matfeld, who's fucking brilliant. An incredible number one, meaning Can you guys explain what number one is?
Number one on the call sheet is your lead actor.
Yeah. And to work in TV, you start to notice patterns amongst number ones. And Perry is a consummate professional, incredibly talented. And, like, you're like, oh, that's why an entire network put all their faith and confidence in you. Because not just, like, a wonderful person, but, like, and has all the skills. But, like, literally, it's like, hit that mark every time. Give me single tier every time. And that woman can fucking do it. Wow. Yeah, while being funny and sweet. And yeah, I love Murphy. I love the idea that there's an entire show about a blind woman trying to solve a crime.
I love it.
Iconic.
Well, Clara.
Vika. Nick.
Clara. Thank you for coming on Daddy Dailies.
Thank you for having me.
We're really excited to see more of your work, including Tracker, which you're going to next to direct. And you guys can watch Murder Camp on Vimeo. It's a staff pick, and you can watch it on Alter. So you should definitely go do that.
Highly recommend.
And
also check out Public Assembly last Thursday of every month. And anything else our guests should know, if you want to, where to find you on the internet or your work or any other work you want to share?
Yeah, I have a website, clarairanovich.com. And when I'm not writing, I'm on Instagram, currently deactivated. But when I'm allowing myself the procrastination tool of Instagram, I am at clarairanovich.
Perfect. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you.
Yay.
Thanks, y'all.
Yay. And you can follow Not Your Daddies at NYD Films on Instagram.
Do it.
Daddy Dailies is presented by Not Your Daddies Films, a social impact organization dedicated to educating and empowering women and non-binary creatives in TV and film. If you like what you heard today, don't forget to subscribe and leave us a positive review. And if you want more Daddy episode insights and links to what we talked about, join us on Patreon.com/NYD Films. Daddy Dailies is produced in partnership with Robert Bailey and edited by Carly Tamarin, Vika Stubblebine, Claudia Restrepo, and Gracie Strauss. See you next time, Daddy.